Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. We'll begin reading at verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, and the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the harp, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" We'll stop there for the day. Now, if you've been with us through this study, you know that Nebuchadnezzar has come face to face with one of God's prophets. And really, even he himself was given a dream by the true God of heaven for that prophet to interpret for him. And at the end of chapter 2, he seems moved. And I think it's fair to say that he was. But his attitude, which we will see through his actions today, seemed quite similar to Agrippa when Paul stood before him. You may recall, Paul stood before Agrippa and witnessed of the person and majesty of the Lord Jesus Christ. And Agrippa was moved. He was intrigued even. But he was not convinced. And at this point in this book, Nebuchadnezzar is not convinced. He's just intrigued. Now in the last chapter, we saw that he had this dream, a dream that Daniel ultimately interpreted, a dream that God gave him concerning the Gentile kingdoms all the way leading up to the coming of Christ. It's fascinating, really, when you study that. And though the chapter ended in verse 47 with Nebuchadnezzar saying to Daniel, truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, here in chapter 3, we find him seemingly back to his polytheistic pagan ways. Now, if you could stand it, I'd cover all of this in one sitting. But when I'm done, you'll be glad I didn't. There's a lot that's here, and I want us to make sure that we have a good picture. The name of the sermon this morning is Unbending Faith. Unbending Faith. This passage shows us what living counterculturally looks like in these three men. At a time when nobody would have blamed them if they didn't. At a time when nobody else was doing it. They refused to bow down to this image, and they stood tall for God. This chapter is a great example for us in a postmodern society like we live in. So it begins by saying that King Nebuchadnezzar made this image of gold. Its height was 60 cubits, its breadth was 6 cubits. He set it up in what's called here the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then he sent to all of his government officials to come to the dedication of this image that he had set up. And they all gather, and it says that they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, no time frame is given here in this chapter as to when this occurred in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. We aren't told. Some commentators seem to have this idea that this may have occurred 20 years after chapter 2. That seems quite unlikely, at least to me. First of all, there's really no break here in the reading. I know we have a tendency to read from a chapter break point of view because we think, you know, Daniel finished chapter 2 and then he wrote chapter 3 and then he started writing. But that's just not the case. Chapter divisions in Scripture weren't there until around the 13th century A.D., they're beneficial because I can say, open to Daniel chapter 3. Begin reading with verse 1. That helps. But sometimes they mess us up because we think, oh, this is something completely new. Well, that's unlikely. There was no break here. It seems continuous from the reading from the previous section. Secondly, and maybe the stronger proof of this being recent, right after the events of chapter 2, is that Nebuchadnezzar seems here, at least to me, to still be a young king attempting to establish, or as it is, to demand, loyalty of those officials in his new administration. So it seems likely to have occurred early in his reign to me rather than later. Now, I also mentioned most commentators seem to believe that there is some link between the dream that he had in chapter 2 and this image. We'll talk about that a little bit as we go on, but that is probably the case. This dream absolutely had an impact on him. There's no question about that. This is a dream that none of his wise men in Babylon and none of the servants of the pagan gods of Babylon were able to do anything with. He wanted them to tell him what he dreamed. They couldn't. And he wouldn't even allow them to give the interpretation because of their inability here. But Daniel could. And so Nebuchadnezzar makes that glowing statement in verse 47 that truly, Daniel, your God is God of gods. He is Lord of kings. He is a revealer of mysteries. So he's impressed with God, and he's impacted by what we see happen in chapter 2. We know it at least occurred afterwards because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had already been appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to a high office here. So we at least know that it did happen afterwards. Now this statue that he built, it's referred to here as an image. Just think of a statue. It's probably fashioned like a human being. It's made of gold, probably not solid gold. Probably it's, you know, wooden and it's gold-plated. It would have been difficult to lift a statue of gold this big after they got it built. I guess they could have built it you know, standing up. But most likely it's wood with gold plating. This is quite an enormous statue. It's a monstrosity, if you will. Now, I'm assuming most of you don't know how tall you are in cubits. So you probably don't know how tall this is. I'll do the math for you really quickly. Originally, a cubit measured from your elbow to the end of your hand. But if me and Burl are measuring and building something together, that ain't going to work real well because he got a longer cubit than I have. So really quickly, they came up with more of a standard cubit, and it's around 18 inches. A cubit multiplied here by 60 then is going to be around 90 feet tall. The odd thing is it's only about 9 feet wide. That's odd when you consider this probably made into the image like a man. If that is the case, it is grotesque if it is literally 90 feet tall. But there are some explanations that have been offered, both of which seem legitimate. Some people seem to think this is like more like a totem pole, which would have been fashioned like a man. It would have had a head and it would have had arms in the pole, but that it would have just been fashioned in that way and was meant to look the way that it did. But perhaps the better hypothesis is that it was sitting on a platform, which itself may have been 30 or 40 feet high, making then the statue only be about 50 feet tall. That would bring it more into the normal dimensions of a human being here. Whatever it is a huge structure. And you notice Nebuchadnezzar set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It's in the Babylonian province, but it was not inside the city. It was in the area where Babylon ruled and controlled, but it was outside the city of Babylon in this plain area, a more open area. Now, the word Dura would refer to something that was flat, but it was surrounded by walls. So most commentators believe that there's a plain out here inside this mountainous region. That would have made this statue the most dominant feature of this area. In fact, as you approached this plain, the statue would have been the most notable thing that you saw on the horizon as you walked this way, and it would have made quite an impression. We really don't know exactly where this is today, but many have offered the location, it's called today at least, Tolol Dura. It's about 12 miles south-southeast of modern-day Hilla. And in the 19th century, interestingly enough, there was a French archaeologist. I know several of you probably are familiar with French archaeology, but for those of you that aren't, I'll tell you. His name was Julius Opert, and he actually discovered the remains of a brick structure, a square brick structure, 30, 40 feet high, that he believed, at least, was the place on which this image stood. It's possible, but we don't know for sure. But the bigger question is, what is the image? Well, some believe it was just an idol of one of the Babylonian gods, though I just don't think that's realistic. Three times in this chapter, the gods of the Babylonians are distinguished from this image. Notice in verse 12, it says, "There are certain Jews whom you've appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you, nor do they serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." Verse 14 says, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image that I have set up?" And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego then say the same thing in verse 18. "Be it known to you, O king, we will not serve your gods or worship the image that you've set up." It seems like this image that the king has set up is distinct from the gods of the Babylonians. And it's said to be that by three different groups. By the accusers, by the king himself, and by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So most commentators believe this is not a Babylonian god. This is something else altogether. And there are three primary hypotheses about what this is. All of them make sense, but in my mind, one makes the best sense. First, some believe that this image, based on Nebuchadnezzar's dream in which he saw this head of gold that represented Babylon, some believe that this image was merely a representation of Babylon and the Babylonian Empire. That's reasonable. I mean, you have an image and it's all gold, not just the head like it was in his dream, but the whole thing is gold. And certainly the people of Babylon had great allegiance to the empire, but Nebuchadnezzar would have wanted to know they had a whole lot of allegiance, enough that they were willing to bow down. But it seems unlikely to me, at least, that they would be asked to worship the empire itself. This is an act of worship, so that's probably not what's going on here. Other commentators seem to believe that this is actually an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Now listen, Nebuchadnezzar is full of pride. There's no doubt about that. You find that out in the last line that we read today. Which God is going to help you out of my hands? Well, it was common back in those days for kings to make images of themselves. Just go study the ancient Egyptians. They're all over the place there. But there's nothing in this passage that suggests that Nebuchadnezzar was demanding worship of himself. He certainly is demanding allegiance to his empire. He is requesting that they worship the gods of the Babylonians. He is demanding that they bow down to this image. But there's nothing that suggests he wants to be worshiped here. And from what we read in secular history, the Babylonian kings did not consider themselves to be gods the way that the pharaohs did. So that's probably not what's going on here. The last hypothesis, and I think probably the most likely, is that Nebuchadnezzar was so moved by this dream that he had that was given to him by Daniel's God that this is an attempt from Nebuchadnezzar to worship the God that was revealed to him in Daniel chapter 2, to worship Yahweh. He was clearly impacted. Again, he says to Daniel, "Truly your God is a God of gods, Lord of kings, revealer of mysteries." And he has been able to reveal this mystery. Nebuchadnezzar had not been worshiping the God of Daniel prior to this. Now he desires to, it seems. The problem is, he's still thinking with a pagan heart and a pagan mind. He has some zeal, but he has no knowledge. And what he ends up doing here not only does not worship God, but actually contradicts everything that God has told us about Himself. God is not to be worshiped in this way. This is a violation of the Mosaic Law. Exodus 20, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them and serve them." The point is here, not that you can't take a family photo. That's not what it means. But you can't take a photograph and bow down and worship that photograph. And that's exactly what's going on here. They've made an image. So if this is an attempt to worship Yahweh, Nebuchadnezzar still viewed a refusal as a slight against himself and against his kingdom. That will become clear as we go. Absolute monarchs can be pretty stubborn, as history tells us. So the king, he's excited. He's built this image. He invites all of the rulers throughout the Babylonian Empire from obviously various language groups, various cultures, various peoples. He invites them here to the dedication of his image. And they're listed: satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, justices, magistrates, and then it more broadly says, and all the officials of the provinces. Now we know that the satraps, at least, were the highest of the rulers underneath Nebuchadnezzar himself. They ruled over a large area. And it seems as you work your way down, it works from the order of the most prominent in authority to the least in authority, and the very least would have been, and all the others. That may be your local dog catcher, you know, your postmaster, I don't know. But it would have gone from those that ruled in a broad area all the way down to the least that ruled over the smallest area. Most likely this would have been hundreds of officials gathered for what is a very magnificent event. And I am certain they were dressed to a T in their finest uniforms. Now the question is, where is Daniel? That's a good question. I mean, it's a question that is really unanswerable. But he is absent in this chapter. He is not mentioned at all. We can be certain from what we read in chapter 1 that if Daniel was here, he would absolutely not have bowed down and worshiped this image. He wouldn't even eat the king's diet. We know good and well he's not going to bow down and worship this image. But where is he? I don't know. It's possible that he remained in the city of Babylon. This is not there. Somebody would have been left, certainly, to run the government. Maybe he's back there. Or, perhaps more likely, Daniel's just out of town doing the king's business. Look, he is second in line at this point. He would have been the man that was sent elsewhere to represent Nebuchadnezzar while he stayed back in the palace eating bonbons and grapes. That's how it worked back in these days. He sent somebody to do his work, and Daniel is probably just away on business. That's all speculation. But we can be confident Daniel isn't here. He would have stood with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had he been there. Now, I don't know if these officials knew precisely why they were there or not. But as they walked up to this plane, and that statue got larger and larger and larger in this polytheistic pagan society, it probably became more and more clear why they had been summoned there. And by the time this herald speaks up here in verse 4, it may be that they fully comprehended it. They certainly comply very quickly. So this herald speaks up in verse 4 and says, "You are commanded." Not, "You are given the opportunity if you'd like to." That's not what's going on here. "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages." You see, these are people from all throughout the empire. "That when you hear the sound of all of these instruments, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." We know from history, heralds were very common in Babylon. This is just how they officially did things. Not only in Babylon, through other countries throughout history, we know this. This is a man whose position and responsibility was very simple. You say to whom I send you what I tell you to say. That's what the king would have told him. He was in no way allowed to change the message. By the way, that's how the Bible views a church leader. He is a herald of God. He has been given what God has told him to say, and he is not allowed to change the message at all. That's a high calling, and that's what you as a church should expect. But that's not what this passage is necessarily about. Now, this man changed the message of the king. It wasn't going to go very well for him. So he doesn't. He tells them what the king said. "When the music sounds, hit your knees, worship this image, or else." That's what the king has required. And these instruments here that are listed, they represent, I guess you'd say, the best of the best as far as instruments are concerned. Now, I'm not the biggest bagpipe lover, but it was popular back in these days. Some of these are wind instruments. Some of these are stringed instruments. Then you have an instrument like the bagpipe. This is not a brass ensemble. This is not a brass quartet or anything like this. You need to think on terms of this is a symphony orchestra. This is a huge group of people playing music. Some have even suggested this was an official orchestra of Babylon that often played at Babylonian events, not just here. I'm sure that that is the case. Nebuchadnezzar would have demanded the best of the best. We know that. Now, God has established music for our good. We just sang a beautiful hymn, several, actually. Before the throne of God above. That's great. Music is to be used by God in worship, but Satan uses music too. But he doesn't use it for our good. And this is an example of that. Music has a way to stir us. And as long as it's not stirring us to sin, that's fine. But when he begins to do that, it becomes the tool of Satan. Now, let me say, some pastors will go so far as to say that all secular music is of the devil. I think that's a bit extreme. I don't think we can say that. If that were the case, we can't even sing Happy Birthday at a birthday party. That's a secular song. I think that's sort of silly. I heard of a pastor, a Baptist pastor, embarrassingly, who said that if you tap your foot when the church is singing, you're sinning. That's ridiculous. Extra-biblical legalism. That's not what I'm talking about. Such an approach to the beat of music is just grasping at straws and something that we don't have here. But some music is filthy. And some music encourages sinful behavior. That type of music should be avoided by God's people. I'm not saying you can't listen to secular music, but it doesn't need to be encouraging you to sin. It needs to be good, clean music. That's simple enough. But that's not what's going on here. This is, at the very root, satanic music that is leading them to worship Satan indirectly. I mean, the worship of any god other than the true and living God is ultimately following Satan. God's design is for music to work on us, but Satan has perverted that here. Now, right near this image that they were commanded to worship, visible to everybody, is a furnace burning with fire. They can see it. We know that because of everything that unfolds in this chapter. It's clear. It's right here on sight. They are given a very vivid picture of what is going to happen to them if they do not do what the king demands. This is probably something similar to a lime kiln, K-I-L-N, today. It would have been shaped like an old-fashioned milk bottle. Parents, explain that to your kids later. You know, it's small at the top and it gets bigger as you go. And you would drop in whatever you're burning at the top and you would remove what you wanted to from an opening on the side. It was used back in these days for extracting metals. Why would it be on site? Well, probably they used it in extracting the gold, liquefying the gold, so that they could plate this image with it. They probably had used it in the construction of this image, but now they were using it for something else. Now it was going to be used to convince people what they needed to do or else. And most men are going to bow down, because most are far more committed to themselves than they are to their God. Verse 7. This has been commanded. They've been told what's going to happen. Therefore, as soon as the music played, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This is not a surprise. They've been told if they don't worship, they're going to be put to death. Therefore, as Daniel writes, therefore, they all bowed down. I mean, this is exactly what you would expect. And listen, there probably are Hebrew people bowing down in this crowd. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not the only Jews there. And these people are very clear that there are certain Jews which don't bow down. And he names them by name. That means there are probably other Jews whose history goes all the way back to Abraham that bow down and worship this image. Listen, I don't believe Daniel was there. There's no reason to think that Daniel would have bowed. There's every reason to consider that he was something else, somewhere else, because he had the power to go somewhere else. But other Jews were still captives, and they weren't allowed to wander off. They're here. You can understand the Gentiles bowing down. This is just another god to them. They already worship a bunch of gods. Watch one more. No big deal. Hindus today believe in thousands and thousands of gods. One more isn't hurting anybody, except they don't want Jesus as one of those gods. Isn't that terrible? But the fact that Jews bow down, prostrate themselves before this man-made idol, that's different. It's unacceptable. But there were three exceptions. Verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods, and they will not worship the image that you have set up. Now these Chaldeans, Chaldean is a word that is sometimes used of all Babylonians. It's also a word that is sometimes used as a certain group of wise men. You may not like that because it's confusing, but it's clear. These aren't just Babylonians. These are men which had an audience with the king. These are probably what we would refer to as astrologers, which would have made them wise men of Babylon. And notice here, it says they maliciously accuse the Jews. The Aramaic word, you know, this portion of Daniel is in Aramaic, not Hebrew. But this Aramaic word translated maliciously accused literally translates as they ate their pieces. You say, well, that's a little different. I thought all these Bibles were literal. Well, we don't get that. Maliciously attacked makes a lot more sense. This is an idiom. But a modern phrase may be something like, they chewed them out. You see the connection? They ate their pieces. They chewed them out. Except it's just probably not strong enough. Understand, this is anti-Semitism. They hated the Jews because they were Jews. They did. There are certain Jews. They have maliciously attacked the Jews. They did not like the Jews. And that is still the case today in our world, we know that. But there's probably also some personal jealousy going on here. You've got these 20-year-old, probably, kids that just got here with a band of captives, and they've been appointed as high officials here in Babylon instead of these people that probably have been in Babylon all their life. They don't like these people. And though their rant began with the words, O king, live forever, they still offered a backhanded accusation against Nebuchadnezzar. Did you catch it? Here's what they said. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. In other words, this wouldn't be an issue if you wouldn't have appointed these Jews to this office, O king. If you had appointed Babylonians to this office, we wouldn't be having this problem right now. O king, live forever. They're just being formal. But Nebuchadnezzar made an error in their minds when he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to this office. And they're making sure they know. And they remind the king as if he needed reminding of what he said. You said if the people didn't bow down at the music, they would be cast into this fiery furnace. And then they pointed at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and said, those guys right there, they did not bow. If you notice, they accuse them of three things. First, in attempting to play to Nebuchadnezzar's pride, which we know he had, they said, these men, O king, pay no attention to you. I don't believe that's true. That's a false accusation. That's a lie. What they're saying here is that these men did not respect Nebuchadnezzar as a ruler. And there's nothing in this entire book that suggests that Daniel or these three did not respect him in so much as they were required to. That's not true. This is a false charge. They do respect Nebuchadnezzar. But their respect for Nebuchadnezzar did not extend to doing things Nebuchadnezzar demanded them do if it's unbiblical. Their second charge did have merit. They said, they do not serve your gods. Well, that is true. They didn't. They had made that very clear back in chapter 1 when they refused to eat the diet of the Babylonian king, fearful, no doubt, that they would break the Mosaic law. This third charge is also true. They do not worship the golden image that you have set up. And this would have been noticeable. Hundreds of people bow down, and three stayed standing. That would have been noticeable. May not have been noticeable to Nebuchadnezzar, but it would have been noticeable to somebody. And just in case Nebuchadnezzar missed it, he had these trustworthy Chaldeans to come and let him know that it had happened. And get this now, back in chapter 1, they had stood firm back then too. But Daniel's the leader back there, clearly. He's the one that is leading them and guiding them. You might have even wondered, I wonder how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have responded if Daniel hadn't have been there. Would they have eaten the king's food, maybe? No, they would not. They were men of integrity. Daniel is not here, and they still stand their ground, and they will not bow down. We find that these men are just as faithful as Daniel. They just have not been given the same office that Daniel has been given. And folks, we've not all been called to the same office, but we are to be faithful in whatever capacity God has placed us in. They were. We ought to see that here. We ought to earn a lot of respect from these men. Now verse 13 tells us that Nebuchadnezzar became enraged. He is furious. And so they bring these men before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar asks them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, I'll give you one more chance. When the music plays, if you will now bow down and worship, good and well. But if you don't, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Here are these three kids, really. 19, 20, 21 years old. They've been kidnapped from their families. They've been drug hundreds of miles away from their homes. They stood before this monarch who had put them into authoritative positions. And I'm sure in his mind, he'd been very gracious to them. And from the world standpoint, he had been. It's rare for a kidnapped captive, an exile, to be put in such a position. And here they're refusing to bow down to this image that he no doubt had put a ton of work and energy into. I'm sure he feels personally slighted here. And if this is an attempt to worship Yahweh, I'm sure he could not for the life of him understand why three Jews wouldn't bow down to this image. But that's because he would have had zeal with no knowledge. Again, what he's doing is not the worship of Yahweh. What he's doing is idolatry. So he flew into a rage and he ordered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be brought before him. This is a huge event. Tons of Babylonian dollars or whatever, you know, currency they had been spent on this. A lot of effort had been spent getting this ready. A lot of preparation to make sure that everything went very smoothly. And here's a bump in the road. He's not happy. From a human perspective, you can sort of see why he's angry. You ever have a project that you plan and put a lot of effort into and it just falls apart and unravels? We get frustrated. But from a biblical perspective, he is wrong. And it's obvious why. Now, I don't know if he doubted the trustworthiness of his other wise men. He sure seemed to in chapter 2 when he said, no, you need to tell me the dream before you tell me the interpretation. He seemed to have some doubts of them. But he questions these three men himself. He doesn't take the wise men's word for it. He says, is it true? Is it true that you will not bow down? Do you really refuse this? And let's give him a little bit of credit. Unlike most emperors, he actually gives them a second chance, even though he's so enraged. There is some level-headedness here, but not without a warning. You got another chance, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Now put yourself in their shoes for a second. These are our heroes of the faith right here. This is who we should be looking up to. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But put yourself in their shoes. They really lived through this. This is not fiction. This happened. These three boys literally stood before this monarch and they were told to bow down to this image or you will be cast into that furnace right there. They had to be scared. I would be. This would be terrifying at best. And then notice Nebuchadnezzar's final line. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Well, that's just so hard for us to even read. So blasphemous. This is a challenge to God. This is a challenge like Pharaoh issued to God. Pharaoh never believed that Yahweh would have been able to get the Jews out of Egypt, but he was wrong. It really reminds me of the Rabshakeh when he was sent to Israel to threaten King Hezekiah back in Isaiah 36. Some of you may recall, but he goes and tells them that he is about to lay siege to Jerusalem. And here's what the Rabshakeh said. He said, "Beware lest Hezekiah, the king of Judah, mislead you by saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any of the gods of the nation delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their lands out of my hand that the Lord, Yahweh, should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" You see, that's arrogance. Arrogance towards the true and living God. Well, that wasn't wise. Because the next chapter tells us that an angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 of the Assyrians in their camp. God conquered. That's the same God who is going to deliver these three boys in a very unexpected way. They don't know if they're going to be delivered. We'll see that in the next passage, Lord willing. They have no idea if they're going to live through this or not. But God did. We're going to see that in the next time we come together for this, we're going to see that Nebuchadnezzar is actually going to go to great lengths to make sure that God doesn't deliver out of their hands. But there are no lengths that he can go to thwart God's will. He will fail. We've been introduced here to three young men who had unbending faith. They refused to bow down and worship this image. You know, it's been said, stand up for what is right, even if you have to stand alone. And that's what they do. Hundreds bowed. No doubt many Hebrews bowed. Their own kinsmen. Who knew better? But they didn't. And again, back in chapter 1, they had Daniel as their leader, but here we learn that they had all the integrity necessary to stand up for God on their own. You know, I fear that in our society, the devil has it a whole lot easier to get God's people to do wrong than he did back then. Back then, this came through idol worship. Not so much today. Listen, the devil's goal is to get our focus away from serving God, whatever that may take. That may come in the form of peer pressure. That's not just for kids, by the way. Adults fall to peer pressure just as often as children do. No doubt. It's a powerful tool of our adversary. Listen, it is hard to bow your head and pray when others aren't. It's hard to carry your Bible when others aren't. It's easy to do things wrong when others are. That's peer pressure. We all fall for that. But even more in our day, the availability of toys in our society is often a tool of Satan to get us distracted. He's tickled to death if we just put God on the back burner. He's happy. Now, I'm not suggesting you can't have a hobby. I have some. But you cannot allow hobbies to control you and dominate every thought. You cannot become obsessed with a hobby. Another point here, I guess I'll step on your toes before I'm done. We are to obey the government. We are to. With two exceptions. When the government requires us to do something that the Bible forbids, then we balk. Or when the government disallows us from doing something the Bible requires, then we balk. But otherwise, we follow the government. Jeffrey King writes, quote, "Let us see to it that we do not refuse to obey for any paltry end or our own pride or prejudice. But if we have the Word of God clearly and unmistakably, then in obedience to that, we must defy the authorities." Close quote. Only when we have Scripture do we tell the government we're not going to do what you want. Otherwise, we follow. We do. God ordained government. The Bible says that again and again and again. Paul says it twice. Peter says it once. Government has been established by God. Listen, one of the things I've seen lately is so many Christian people boldly speaking about how they're not going to follow this mask ordinance right now. I'm not doing it. Well, you're wrong. It is not an unbiblical rule. It is legitimate. I'm not saying I like it. I wear glasses. I hate it. There are a few things that glasses-wearing people like about wearing a mask that fogs up, but there's nothing unscriptural about wearing a mask during an epidemic. And to refuse to do so is not refusing to follow the government, folks. It's refusing to follow this book right here, which ultimately means we are refusing to follow God. We follow the government until they tell us to do something that the law tells us otherwise. Paul wrote to Timothy saying, "First of all, then I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, listen, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good and pleasing in the sight of our God." If peaceful and quiet doesn't describe us, even politically, we are wrong. We are to be peaceful and quiet. And the Bible is very, very clear. Lastly, I'll get off your feet. Nebuchadnezzar was caught up in the wrong thing. He was caught up in the head of gold. He was caught up in his kingdom. He was caught up in the here and now. He wasn't giving any thought for the there and then. He was caught up with this world and what it had to offer. And he was thinking nothing about a city which was made without hands, a city whose builder and maker is God. He had no thought for that. The sooner that we come to grips with our own mortality, the better. You're going to die unless Jesus comes back. I don't know how, but you're going to. That may be today. I don't know. But you need to come to grips with it. More than that, you need to come to grips with the fact that you and your sins naturally are an offense to God. It's a stench in His nostrils. Because we are all sinners at our core, rebels to God and His right kingship, if you will. And only when we come to grips with that will we be willing, by God's grace, to dump our pride, deny ourselves, and put all our faith and trust and hope in the finished work of Jesus Christ. Nebuchadnezzar is not there yet. He will be. Give us time. But at this point, he is unwilling to see the forest for the trees, as it was. He is caught up with the here and now. But there are three people in this passage that we've read, and we'll look at next time, three people who had a much greater view of reality. They understood that God was their sole king, and what he had going on mattered a whole lot more than what Nebuchadnezzar had going on. So they weren't fearful of a furnace, because it could only kill the body. But God's got power to kill the soul. Stand with me if you will.